welcome to the Hyphen Church Podcast, where faith meets the spaces in between. We're here to explore what it means to belong, to grow, and to encounter God in the midst of life's questions and complexities. Whether you're here to listen, reflect, or take a step forward, know that you're in the right place. Let's make space together for what God is doing in us and through us. Now, let's dive into today's message.
We're still in the wilderness, though. We're still in those moments of life where we have to live in that dryness. We have to live in those parts where we're desperate or we're deprived or we're in a place of darkness, as we're going to see next week. But this week, we're going to be in a place of dryness. And we're going to be in the book of Ezekiel. Now, the whole book of Ezekiel is coming out of a place of Israel and Judah living in a time of exile. So they are in Babylon. They are not in their homeland. They are longing for home. They're longing to go home. And that's a really important feature of this book. When you read Ezekiel, you're going to have to know that they're not in the place where they are supposed to be. And so the trauma of the community and the overwhelming loss of this sort of taken for granted reality of the life in the land, the destruction of the temple, the identity of the covenant with their God, all of these things are being called into question because they cannot see their home. They cannot see where they are. And so they are in the midst of this exile. They are in the wilderness. They are away from home. And so this is a moment of the prophet Ezekiel speaking words that the people he's speaking to are not likely to believe or listen to because they are in overwhelming trauma of their life. And so we want to open this up to Ezekiel 37, and this is maybe the most famous story in Ezekiel, the most famous event in Ezekiel. And we're going to read it, and there's a lot of famous songs out there recently about this event. So it was in Ezekiel first, and then it became a song, just so you know the timeline of events there in that. Ezekiel 37, 1 through 14 says, "The hand of the Lord was on me," meaning Ezekiel, "and he brought me out of by the Spirit of the Lord and set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them, and I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry. He asked me, 'Son of man, can these bones live?' I said, 'Sovereign Lord, you alone know.' Then he said to me, 'Prophesy to the bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you and you will come to life, and then you will know that I am the Lord.' So I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then he said to me, 'Prophesy to the breath, prophesy, son of man, and say to it, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Come, breath from the four winds, and breathe into these slain, that they may live.' So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them. They came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army. Then he said to me, 'Son of man, these bones are the people of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We are cut off. Therefore, prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. My people, I am going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. Then you, my people, will know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and bring you up from them. I will put my spirit in you and you will live, and I will settle you in your own land, and you will know that I, the Lord, have spoken and I have done it, declares the Lord." Will you pray with me? Father, what a great word from you this morning. Let it sit firmly in our hearts. Let it enter our ears. Let it energize us. Let the Spirit of the Lord enter our bones this morning as we hear your word and we act on it. In your Son we pray, amen. Son of man, can these bones live? Son of man, can these bones live? Our bones are dried up. Our hope is gone. We are cut off. People sometimes ask me, when I'm gone, when I'm buried, is it okay if I'm cremated? Absolutely. Read Ezekiel 37. These are very dry bones. And somehow, this is a spooky story, by the way, somehow these bones rise up. And there are muscles and tendons flying in from everywhere or growing off the bones. And there's, it doesn't say this, but I'm sure they have to have skin. I'm sure they do. And then hearts and lungs and organs grow and all of these things happen. And should I be cremated? Sure, that's fine. Whatever you want. Because nothing is beyond God. Read Ezekiel 37. These are very dry bones. And I think one of the most important parts of this event is that God brings Ezekiel to the Valley of Bones and he makes him walk among the bones. In verse 2, he says, he led me back and forth among them. Boy, that's a rotten thing to do. This is a spooky graveyard. And God says, why don't you just walk back and forth among the bones? Son of man, can these bones live? This is the fifth week of Lent, and we are deep into the wilderness. And the question today isn't whether we can survive it. The question is, can what's dead come back to life? What does it mean that God asks Ezekiel a question he already knows the answer to? That is really a rotten thing that God does to us sometimes, isn't it? Well, what do you think I should do? Well, why don't you feed them? What is it that you desire? These are the great questions of Jesus. These are the great questions of God as he interacts with his people. He doesn't always tell them the answers, right? He leads them to a place and says, what do you want? What do you think, Ezekiel? Can these bones live? What do you think, Ezekiel? Can these bones come back to life? God doesn't just show Ezekiel. God is forcing him to see the scope of this, the sheer number, the brutal finality of life, of the Israelites, of all bodies that walk the earth. And these are not freshly slain bodies. They're not just decomposing, they are very dry, brittle, gone for a very long time. This is death that has been settled into, death that has been normalized, death that no longer shocks because it's been the reality for so long that everyone has forgotten what life looks like. This is Israel in exile, 70 years removed from Jerusalem, a generation that has been born and has died in Babylon. The temple is rubble, the city is ash, and the people have stopped asking when they'll go home because it just feels like a question that has no answer. Can these bones live? We're not suffering. We're not waiting anymore. We're finished. We're done. We've given up all hope. Why does God ask this question? He's God. He knows the answer. He's about to demonstrate the answer. So why would he frustrate Ezekiel? Why would he frustrate us by asking us simple questions that he knows so much about? Because the question isn't for God's information, it's for Ezekiel's imagination. See, God is asking Ezekiel a vision question. Can you conceive of this? Can you see what can happen with this? Can you picture resurrection when you're standing in a mass grave? Can you hope for what you've never seen before? Can you see it, Ezekiel? See, the question isn't, can these bones live? The question is, Ezekiel, what can I do with this? So God is asking a vision question. And Ezekiel's answer is perfect. Lord, only you know. What can happen here? God only knows what can happen here. This isn't faith. This isn't doubt. This is honesty with God. Ezekiel doesn't say, yes, of course they can live, God. He doesn't say, no, it's too late. He says, I don't know. But I know you do. And that's good enough for me. Sometimes the most faithful thing you can say in the face of death is, I have no idea if this can live again, but God, you do. And there's a kind of hope that's just optimism, wearing a Jesus t-shirt. It's the hope that says everything is going to work out. Romans 8:28, he works all things for those who do him well. But there's not always evidence of that, right? We can be faithful and we can do all these things and we can pray. And what happens then? God, I know that you can do this. I don't know if it's going to live or not. I can't see it. I don't know how, but I'm standing in this valley because God brought me here. And if he's asking the question, maybe he is about to answer it. I know a hospice chaplain who sits with families in their final hour. It's tough work. It's brutal work. And he told me about a moment that stayed with him. He was sitting with a woman's husband. The husband was dying with cancer, stage 4, months of treatment. There was nothing left to try. And the doctor said it was days, maybe hours that he had left to live. And the woman looked at this chaplain and she said, do you think God can still heal him? Now, in that moment, the chaplain had a choice. You know, he could have said, yes, God can do everything, which is a pastoral, true, but very empty sort of way of saying things. And he could have said, well, let's focus on making peace, which is, again, a softer way to say it, but kind of evasive to the whole thing. And instead, he told me that he said, I don't know, but I know God is here, and I know that whether your husband lives or dies, God's power to resurrect isn't limited by what we can see in this room. He was able to honor the death that she was staring at because he honored the God who specializes in that. Can these bones live? Sometimes the answer isn't yes or no. Sometimes the answer is you alone know, and that's enough. The theologian Walter Brueggemann says this, the prophet does not ask if the people want to be healed or if they think they can be healed. The prophet asks if God can heal. And the answer is always the same. I do not know, but God does. We need to have the capacity to envision what seems impossible because God is the God of impossible. Ezekiel's you alone know isn't a resignation, it's a realism. He's naming the resurrection is God's work, not ours. And that frees us up to not having to manufacture hope that we don't feel. You alone, God, can bring this resurrection. Last week, we talked about Elijah fleeing into the cave. This week, God brings Ezekiel into the valley of death. He doesn't let him flee. Elijah ran from despair. Ezekiel was forced to stand into it. And the question is always the same. Will you meet and trust God's presence in the place that you least expect to find it? Elijah had to stop fleeing and start pursuing, and Ezekiel has to stop avoiding the death and start prophesying to it. Both require that shift. I can't do this. A shift to God, you alone know what is possible. What death have you been staring at so long that you've stopped asking if it can live again? What relationship? What process? What function? What piece of you? What would it mean to turn to God and say, I don't know if this can be resurrected, but you do? I'm sure there's a person in your life. I'm sure there's a piece of you that has died a long time ago. I'm sure there's something that you've longed for that has just felt like a dead end for so long. And you've given up hope, and these bones feel dry and brittle. And God, can these bones live? I don't know. And we've been chasing them down, and I've been trying to stay strong, and I've tried to be filled with hope. And only you alone know, God. And so what do we do when we still feel lifeless? Why does God make Ezekiel prophesy to the bones before anything happens? And what does it mean to obey when there's a terrifying gap between the effort and the outcome? That scary middle section where we have to stop and say, I've put forth everything into this. I've given my whole life to this thing, and I'm not seeing fruit any longer. I'm not seeing fruit yet. I'm not seeing anything happen. God doesn't tell Ezekiel what's going to happen. He just commands Ezekiel to make it happen. Prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. That's absurd. Bones don't have ears, right? Dead things don't respond to sermons. This isn't faith. This is performance art. Let's see. Just show us a show. Do these great big things with these bones. Let's see them dance again. But Ezekiel does it anyway because his God commanded him to do it. So I prophesied as I was commanded, verse 7 says. And something happens. There was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. Bodies fully formed, perfectly assembled, and completely lifeless. And here's where the middle comes in. Verse 8, there was no breath in them. I did what you said. I prophesied. Something happens. The bones came together. Flesh appeared. They look alive, but they're not. They're mannequins. They're shells. Their appearance of life without the reality of life in them. And God makes Ezekiel wait there, staring at the assembled bodies. Why? Because this is where most of us live our lives, right? In the space in between obedience and outcome, between effort and resurrection, between I did what you said, and nothing's actually alive yet. We're all in that waiting zone. We're all in that waiting room to say, God, I've done all of those things. I've done the things you've commanded. I've listened to your will. I've listened to your words. I've done the things that you've called me to do. And I wait on you, God. I wait on you, Lord, as Psalm 130 tells us. And then God speaks again. God is not done speaking in our lives, right? He gives us the first command, and it assembles. And then he gives us the second command, prophesy to the breath. The second command, a second act of obedience, to continue doing what God has called us to. The first prophecy assembles the bones, and the second prophecy calls for the Spirit. And this is the structure. This is the pattern. Structure first, then breath. Form first, then life. Obedience first, then resurrection. And here's the thing. You can't skip to the second part without going through the first part. You can't manufacture the second by doing more of the first. The second is God's work. You have to sit with the obedience. You have to sit with the form. You have to sit with the structure first. And God will move to make the second part happen. Ezekiel can't just keep prophesying to the bones and hope that they start breathing. We can't preach to dead things and hope that there will be life in them. We are waiting on God to do that work. We are waiting in that moment to say, you have built the structure that I've called you to do. You have taken the form. You have followed the path. You have set your life as part of obedience. Now you wait. There's not another thing you can do. Now you wait for the second command. It doesn't have anything to do with bones. It has to do with breath. It has to do with spirit. And sometimes God asks us to do everything we can, knowing it won't be enough because our effort is pointless, but because of our effort, it creates space for His Spirit to move. Our effort creates space for His Spirit to move. And it's not just on us. It's not just on us to do these things. It's not a life of glory that look what I built with my own hands and God came to inhabit it. I listened to the word of God. I was obedient to Him and I did the things He called me to. And so my effort in this creates that space for God to come and move and to give life and to give breath. You can't resurrect the dead. But you can prophesy to them. You can show up. You can obey. You can do the work. And then you wait in that terrifying middle section where things look put together but aren't alive yet. And you can do the second thing. You can call for breath. You can't command. You can pray for spirit. You can't control. You can ask God to do what only He can do. There is a period in farming called the green gap. It's the time between when the crop is planted and when it's ready to harvest. And the seed is in the ground. The shoots are visible. Everything looks like it's working, but you can't eat it. You can't pull it out of the ground yet. You can't sell it. It's not ready. And during that time, the farmer does two things. Tends to the crops, which he can water and weed and protect, and he waits. He waits for what he can't control, the sun, the rain, time. He can't make crops grow faster. He can't force the harvest, but he also can't abandon the field just because it's not ready yet. That's the middle. That's verse 8. There was no breath in them. The work has been done, but the structure is in place, but life hasn't come yet. The question is, will you keep tending? Will you keep showing up, even though things aren't ready? Will you put your time and effort not into growing from dead, but for waiting for life? Or are you going to walk away because it's not finished? Are you going to abandon all hope because it just looks like nothing can live in this thing? Paul wrote in Romans 8, 11, the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead is living in you. The same spirit that Ezekiel calls for in the valley, the same breath, the same wind from the four corners. And Paul promises this, the resurrection isn't just something God did once, it's something he's doing now in you through his spirit. Set our minds on what the Spirit desires. We have a role. We participate. We prophesy. We do the obedience we can do. And we call for the breath we can't control. So what work is God asking you to do while it still feels lifeless? And are you willing to obey even if the breath hasn't come yet? How are we going to give up so early? How are we going to give up so soon before we see the life that God has given us? And after the bones are assembled and covered in flesh, God gives Ezekiel the second command. And this one is stranger. Prophesy to the breath, the spirit, the wind. How do you command wind? How do you speak to something you can't see, you can't touch, you can't control? It doesn't come from Ezekiel's obedience. It comes from God's spirit. Three times in this passage, God says, then you will know that I am the Lord. Why this repetition? You know, when you were in school and a teacher said something twice, that was usually... you should write it down because it's going to be on the test. Repetition means this is an important lesson for you to learn right now. The danger is that Israel is going to miss out on this experience. It's not that they'll doubt that God can resurrect them. It's that they'll think that they've resurrected themselves, right? That they did all this work and they kept the Sabbath and they stayed holy even in this place, but they want to do it themselves. They want to be the ones to pull themselves out of slavery in Egypt. They want to be the ones to pull themselves out of exile in Babylon. And that's the danger in this whole thing. God says, I will do something that's impossible for you to do because I want you to know that it wasn't you, that it was all me. This is God's work and God's power and God's resurrection. I will do it. See, here's the thing that's great about our God, though. Ezekiel participates, but he doesn't produce. We worship a God who wants us to participate in that process. And then by some stroke of luck, we feel very proud of ourselves that God has entered us into this and says, you may participate in all the things that I'm doing in the world. And then we get on our high horse, we get on our pedestal, and we say, look at all the great things that Christianity has accomplished. And let's even go further than that. Look at all the great things our church has accomplished. Oh boy. Oh boy. God has asked us to participate in this thing. But we don't get to produce it. God has a church for his mission, not a mission for his church. And we have to do well to remember the order that that comes in. Because he's not setting us up to get the glory. We're setting him up to get the glory. It's a distinction that really matters because if we think we're the source of life, we'll burn out trying to resurrect what only God can raise. Notice the echo in verse 14. I will put my spirit in you and you will live. He doesn't breathe on them, but he breathes into them. The Hebrew word here, ruah, it's one of those beautiful biblical words that refuses to be pinned down. It means wind, it means breath, it means spirit, all three, all at once. And that's not an accident. The ancient Hebrews understood that these were all expressions of the same reality. The invisible, powerful, life-giving presence of God. You can't see wind, but you can see what it does to the trees. You can't see breath, but you know when it's gone because life stops. You can't see the spirit, but you know when it moves because dead things come alive. That animating thing that happens around us, the Ruah. And you can't even say it without breathing. Ruah. The breath, the wind, the spirit. And it's the same word. Okay, how about this? It's the same word in Genesis 2:7. The Lord God formed a man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. Ruah. An act of creation that only comes from God. God is using this creation language for resurrection. He's saying this isn't just about Israel returning to land. This is about Israel being recreated in my image. Again and again and again. New creation, new breath, new life. And the source is the same. God's Ruah, God's spirit. You can't resurrect yourself. You can't generate your own breath. You can't create life out of death by trying harder, believing more, or working better. Life comes from God, and it comes as a gift, not as an achievement. And notice what it becomes: a vast army. Not individuals, not isolated survivors, an army. Resurrection is corporate. It's communal. The bones don't stand alone. They stand together. And why does that matter? Why do we care that a vast army is created? Why don't we want to be resurrected and be alone for the rest of our lives? Because one of the lies of despair, we said, is that you are alone, that you're the only one who's dry. You're the only one who's dead. You're the only one who's cut off. But when God resurrects, he doesn't just raise individuals. He raises a people. He raises a community in resurrection. And that same spirit that gives you breath is giving breath to others. And when you stand, you'll find that you're standing in a formation of everyone breathing in that spirit of God, part of something bigger than yourself. In his book, Surprised by Hope, N.T. Wright says this: the resurrection of Jesus is the beginning of God's new creation. It is the prototype of what God is going to do with the whole cosmos. This is not just about individual salvation. This is about a renewal at a cosmic level. Ezekiel's vision isn't about Israel going home. It's about God putting the world back together and saying, this is what life looks like. This is what we've come to do. Then came the morning that sealed the promise. Your buried body began to breathe. And out of silence, the roaring lion declared, the grave has no claim on me. God is doing something incredible in our dryness. God is doing something incredible. In fact, that same spirit who raised Jesus from the dead that is living in you, that's not a metaphor. That is a promise. That is a promise to have the spirit and the power in there. And God doesn't just resurrect once. He resurrects continually in you through his spirit. And the source is the same, not your effort, God's spirit. And so the question that I would just ask you this morning is, where are you trying to generate breath on your own instead of calling for the spirit? What would it mean to stop striving and to start asking? And how can we embody some of this stuff? I wrote down three things. The first one is, walk through the valley. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you know it, Psalm 23. Explore something in your life, an area, externally, internally, that confronts you with loss or confronts you with death, a graveyard, a business problem, a photo album of someone who's gone. Don't avoid it. Walk through it and ask God this question. Can this live again? And you might not have a thing in your life right now, but you might see something as you're driving. A broken down home, a broken down car, a broken down family. God, can this live again? The second thing, identify where you're playing God. Am I doing the obedience I can do, or am I trying to generate the breath only God can give? Find a place in your life where you're trying to do the work that God is only doing. And third, do the next obedient thing. Identify one thing God has asked you to do that you've been avoiding because you can't see how it will lead to life. Not the whole resurrection, just the next obedient step. Don't wait for proof, because our calling today is to live each day as persons for whom death holds no fear, as messengers of the unbelievable good news that God's love is more powerful than anything this world can do to us. We are called to spread the word that dry bones can indeed live. Prophesy to the bones this week. Speak life into those dead places. Can these bones live again? Only you know, God. The source of life is never your effort, it's always God's Spirit. But let's land in this place. Your obedience creates the space for His breath to move. Your obedience will create the space for His breath to move. So prophesy to the bones, do the work that you can do, and call for the breath that you can't control. And then wait. And trust that God who asks, can these bones live, is the God who is about to answer His own question.